This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. This week on the program, we're going to change course a little bit. We're going to discuss a couple's retirement plan. In this case, we're going to illustrate and cover several issues confronting many of you that are getting ready to retire or have retired. Number one, we're going to look at long-term care and rising medical expenses. We're going to talk about the fears over the financial markets, especially the last 5 years. We're going to talk about inflation, cost of living that you're facing. And four, the difficulty of maintaining a lifestyle in an era when interest rates are at zero. And finally, reconciling budgets and sources of income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Coming up later on the program, Jim will be talking about elder abuse and elder fraud with Dr. Bonnie Olson, who's a clinical professor at University of California.
And so, Kathleen, let's get right to it. Give our listeners sort of a backgrounder as we discuss today's case.
Well, today's case study is about Joe and Irene Turner. Joe's 70 now. He retired about 5 years ago from an engineering position in the defense industry. And his wife, Irene, she's 65, and she retired at the same time that Joe did. She had worked for about 15 years as a secretary in a law firm after the kids all left home. Right now, both Joe and Irene, they're pretty healthy. They're Californians. You know, they watch their diet. They do their exercising. So they're in pretty good shape. And their families actually have a history of being very long-lived. Joe's parents both lived into their late 80s, and Irene's mom is still going pretty strong. She's 88 years old. She has some health problems, so she's had to be placed into a retirement home. So for both Joe and Irene, there's a possibility of longevity that may involve some need for some specialized care. So long-term care might be something you need to start thinking about.
Well, let's delve right into the financials, and it's no surprise if you've been listening to this program, one of the things that we do when we start a retirement plan is we really get people to focus on a budget, because that's going to drive everything else that you do. And whether it's the kind of investments, your estate plan, gifting, all of these things come into play. And we always start out with the budget. I know it's probably not everybody's favorite subject. And we break that budget up into two parts. And that's very critical, because the most important thing in any budget is called basic necessities. That is, what does it cost you to live on a day-to-day basis? Your house payments, property taxes, income taxes, food, Medicare, supplemental insurance, all of the things that you need to live the lifestyle that you want. And then what we try to do is break that thing up into a separate part of the budget. That's the bucket list. That's the stuff that you like to do. Maybe it's hobbies. Maybe it's travel. It's, joining a country club, getting a motor home, sailing, whatever that is. And so in this case, with the Turners, their basic necessities is $90,000 a year. And the bucket list, which really didn't exist to the extent it does today, was about $20,000 a year, which is travel. And anybody that has traveled lately, as you know, whether you're going to Europe, going to the Asia or any place, travel expenses have gone up considerably. So their basic budget was about $90,000 a year. Add travel expenses of about 20, and that's $110,000. I know a lot of you living in the Midwest or someplace, you may think, wow, $90,000 is a lot of money. Well, in Southern California, where your average middle-class home could be anywhere from $600,000 to $1 million, and you have the highest income taxes, one of the highest property taxes, high sales tax, just about everything costs more here. It was amazing about Kathleen, a little over a couple months ago. My family grew up in Arizona, and I was in Scottsdale, and we went to Whole Foods. And we were buying food for dinner that night. We were staying with some friends. And I remember looking at the counter. One thing I know the cost of is grass-fed beef. And I was looking at grass-fed beef, and I was saying, you know, that's amazing. You guys are a couple dollars cheaper than California. I said, where do you get your beef? He said, from California, which always kind of blew me away. So, but anyway, let's get back to the Turners. The Turners' basic expenses, $90,000, $20,000 a year for travel. So that's $110,000. Now let's take a look at their income. Joe's Social Security will round it off to about $2,500. If we take Irene's, we'll round that off to $1,250. And Joe's pension, roughly about $3,750. So total pension income per month was $7,250. Some of their hobbies were golf, skiing, snow skiing, that is, travel, and fine wines. There was a big part of their budget, which was in fine wines. Both of them are gourmet cooks, so that was something that they liked to do. So we had pension income coming up of $7,250, which isn't bad when you consider, when you look at their budget of $90,000. Well, if you take a look at $90,000 and you divide that by 12, you know, that's about $7,500 a month. So their pension income was that was the thing that I wanted to get them to focus on, was pension income was covering pretty much about 90% of their monthly basic necessities. It was the travel expenses, the extras, that really made a difference here. Now let's take a look at their assets. They had a home in Rancho Bernardo, small 1,800 square foot home. It was worth about $450,000. They did have a $200,000 mortgage, which consisted of both a first and a second on that. They had a condominium in Mammoth that was worth a little over $300,000 with $350,000. That was a $100,000 mortgage. So they had $800,000 in a first and a second home. And they had, against that, they had about $300,000 of debt. Now, let's take a look at their assets. When Joe retired in 2008, he had a pension and he had a 401k program. And basically, he retired, Kathleen, right in the middle of the financial crisis. And fortunate for both Joe and Irene, they rolled over their IRAs into bank CDs. They didn't know, you know, they admitted they weren't really experienced in investing. And so, you know, at the time, they didn't know what to do. The good thing is they didn't lose any money. And so they basically have kept it in cash for the last 5 years before they came in to see us. So Joe's IRA was about $250,000. Irene's IRA was about $100,000. And then they had, outside their IRAs, they had about cash and CDs worth about $50,000. And they were drawing down those CDs every single year to pay for the extras, which were the travel expenses. So they had about $400,000 of investment assets, $800,000 tied up in their home and a second home. So that brought their total assets of about $1.2 million. They had $300,000 of debt against their home. So their net worth was roughly about $900,000. Now, the second home, which was the condo up in Mammoth, that was bought by taking out a second mortgage on their primary residence. And when they were raising the family, when they were, you know, they used to do a lot of snow skiing, and so that was very important to them. But with three kids, two daughters, one son, who none of them live in California, they were spending less time there. And if you take a look at their expenses, as we looked at their budget, they had roughly their mortgage payment, and we'll round it off to roughly about $1,000 a month. Their condo was over $500 a month on their mortgage payment on the condo. You add their property taxes, upkeep on the condo. Basically, that second home was costing them about $1,000 a month.
Jim, I want to just jump in here for a minute and talk about this whole idea of having a second home in retirement. We've had several clients who have either retired and purchased a second home or who have already had a second home that they keep carrying with them when they go into retirement. And I think one of the things that people tend to forget about when they, especially when they buy a second home in retirement, is they think, oh, I've got plenty of money for my down payment. I've got plenty of money to meet my monthly mortgage payment. But what they forget are all the other things that you pay as well. The upkeep, the gas, the electric, the maintenance, the property taxes. Pretty soon they find themselves in a situation where their budget is being severely impacted by what's essentially kind of a luxury home, a place where they might spend, I don't know, say 1 to 2 months a year, and it's, and yet they're paying $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 out of pocket every year for this 1 to 2 month experience. So for most people, if you're thinking about buying a second home in retirement, don't forget to do all the math. Don't just take a look at the mortgage payment. Take a look at the insurance and all the other expenditures that are going to go into it and ask yourself, net, net, is this expenditure really worth the 1 to 2 months a year I'm going to be spending in this particular location? Because it can make a big difference to your retirement budget.
Oh, absolutely. In the case of Turner's, it wasn't just the little over $500 a month monthly payments. It was the property taxes, which were running a little over $300 a month. And there was the maintenance and everything else that they had to do. And you know, when we talked to them, they basically said, you know, they were spending less than 2 weeks. So, you know, I said to Joe, you know, Joe and Irene, you know, you can get a nice hotel for a heck of a lot less money if you want to go up there and still go skiing. So that was something that was very critical in planning here.
I think what's really important to note here, Jim, is that the Turners came to us because they were having sort of, they were kept dipping into principal that was making them really nervous. And the other thing was, is that they were trying to figure out how to fund some kind of long-term care, but they really couldn't figure out in their budget how that was going to happen. So they came to us to try to figure out, how do we reduce expenses and how do we fund some kind of long-term care plan for ourselves?
Well, that was the top of the list, Kathleen, because they were dipping into principal. They sort of been drawing down their bank balances every year to pay for the trip. It was coming out of cash. And so, you know, you take a look at spending $20,000 a year and travel costs are going up. Based on their current cash balance, they only had about 2.5 years of vacations left. And the cash kept at the bank would be gone. So what we did is we took a look at, look, Joe, you told me you're spending less than 2 weeks out of the year up at the cabin. You can still go skiing up there, stay at a hotel, and it'll be a lot cheaper. So the first thing we did is we suggested that they sell the condo, which would free up about a couple $100,000 of equity tied up in the condo. Secondly, it would cut their monthly expenses down by almost $1,000 a month. So, I mean, keeping the condo to ski just a couple of weeks out of the year was making that very expensive. And so, as I pointed out, just getting rid of the condo alone would almost pay for more than half of their travel expenses. Now, you had mentioned that one of the things that was a concern, especially with Irene's mother, 88, in a retirement home, and longevity running in both sides of the family, they had looked into long-term care policies. And for Joe, I'm just going to round the numbers off, but it would be close to $4,000 a month and about $2,500 a month for Irene. So you were really talking about $6,500 a year at a time they were drawing down principal to pay for their vacation. So they didn't have the money for that. And you take a look at $6,500 a year in terms of healthcare payments over their life expectancy of 25 years, you're talking about almost $170,000 in payments, and there just wasn't the money for that. So what we suggested they do, which is what they did, is sell the condo. And what we did is we took and set up two annuities, one on Joe's life and one on Irene's life, and I'm going to round this off, roughly about $110,000. That would produce about $5,000 a month income on a 10-year certain plan, and that would take care of pretty much any long-term care problems. Now, one of the reasons they like that, number one, first of all, it wasn't spending $6,500 a year. Secondly, if one of them passed away from natural causes, didn't end up in a retirement home, Joe's annuity would go to Irene. Irene's annuity would go to Joe. So the advantage of going with the annuities is if something happened to either spouse, let's say they died of natural causes, Joe's annuity would go to Irene, and likewise, Irene's annuity would go to Joe. And then finally, the surviving spouse, whoever that turned out to be, could then leave that annuity to the kids. So that was number one. On top of that, they could use to tap into the annuities for either emergency cash or even healthcare issues down the road, or if, let's say, they had to go out and buy a new car. This was something you know, when they took a look at it and they analyzed it, as you talked about, Kathleen, when we did the budget, it really struck out. Oh, my goodness, didn't realize with everything we were spending $1,000 a month to maintain a place that we use less than 2 weeks of the year. So what was fortunate for them, they were able to sell during this season the condo and use that proceeds to fund a annuity. We had separate annuities, one on Joe's life and one on Irene's life, and with making each other the beneficiaries.
Just so we're clear for our listeners here, Jim, we've talked a lot about different types of annuities in the past, and most recently we've been focusing on immediate annuities as a way to fund retirement. We're not talking about immediate annuities here for Joe and Irene. We did deferred annuities, which are a different product that essentially grow until they're used. And unlike immediate annuities, which typically you do not leave anything to your heirs if you pass away with an immediate annuity, deferred annuities, you can specify a beneficiary. So in this case, Joe and Irene are doing one of the options we've talked about before in terms of funding long-term care. We've talked in the past about buying long-term care insurance for Joe and Irene. Really didn't make too much financial sense for them, given their longevity patterns. So instead, they self-funded long-term care through deferred annuities. And again, in their minds, it's earmarked for long-term care, but if they need it for something else, that money is still available to them for withdrawal. The other thing they're able to do as well, and I think this is pretty important, Jim, is that they were able to cut their monthly expenditures by $1,000. And that really helps their retirement assets last a whole lot longer. And they use their condo equity to take care of their long-term care needs without having to have a constant ongoing annual payment to make. And while we're thinking about those constant ongoing payments, Jim, as you mentioned earlier in the program, their retirement income was almost meeting, but not quite meeting their basic needs. Did we happen to propose any types of investment solutions for all those assets they had rolled into CDs when they first retired 5 years ago?
That was the second part of the plan, Kathleen, which was when Joe retired, and for our listeners, think back of what the investment environment was like in 2008. The stock market had peaked in the fall of 2007. Stocks were going down. You were getting headlines. You know, every Monday, I remember the Hank Paulson press conferences. Every time Hank spoke, the market went down 500 points. So, you know, the fortunate thing for Joe and Irene, they retired at the end of 2008, and basically they admitted they didn't have any investment expertise, but more importantly, they didn't know what the heck to do. So, I mean, they just basically rolled over their 401k programs into CDs at a bank. And you take a look at both what happened to the economy, one of the worst recessions, which we're still in the doldrums right now, high unemployment, a 40% drop in the stock market. So they retired in the middle of a credit crisis. And fortunately, they were able to put their money in a bank. And that's basically where it stayed. The unfortunate thing is, you know, they were drawing down their CDs at the bank to pay for travel. They did not have it in their budget in terms of what they were earning on their 401ks, even if they drew the interest on their bank CDs, which was about 0.5% a year. They didn't have the money to pay for the long-term care, which would have been an additional $6,500 a year. So basically, what we did is we put a 50-50 program. We put 50% into laddered bonds. Part of those bonds were inflation protected, meaning that there was an inflation clause. So that produced 4% income. And then we did another $200,000 in blue chip dividend paying stocks. That was producing about 3% income. So basically, their IRAs, we were going to get a little over $8,000 a year in interest income from their bond portfolio, about $6,000 in dividends. So that would produce $14,000 a year. So if we take a look at now, their annual pensions from both the defense contractor and plus Social Security was $87,000 a year. The IRAs were $14,000. So their total income was $101,000. By selling the condo, getting rid of those expenses, we brought their budget down, that's their basic necessities, down to a little bit below $80,000. We still kept the $20,000 travel budget, so we had $98,000 with a cushion between expenditures and total income. Really, I mean, we were cutting it close by $3,000. Their expenses were $98,000, their income was $101,000, and that was the other thing they liked about the annuity program. If they did have some extra expenses, maybe trips cost a little more, some expenses of fixing up the existing house, or who knows what emergency, they could take income out of the annuities, which would provide an additional source of income. But the way I got them through their market fears, laddered bond portfolios, when the bonds mature, they would get their money back, and basically blue chip stocks like Coca-Cola, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, companies that produce dividends, predictable income, and provided basic necessities. And the other great thing, too, as I pointed out, the dividends of a lot of these companies have a history of raising those dividends at 10% a year, so they were going to have a rising income stream, which also addressed one of their potential concerns about rising inflation cost and how to deal with that, which also, by, let's say, getting rid of the condo and taking that money and putting it in annuities, they also had the annuities not only for long-term care, but they also had it as sort of like a spare investment account they can draw on, which had the potential to produce another $6,000.
So to summarize, Jim, when the Turners first came to us, they had two real main concerns. The first one is that they were a little uncomfortable that they kept dipping into their savings, into their principal every month to meet their expenses. And the second thing was they were concerned about funding some kind of long-term care plan for themselves, given their family's longevity patterns and potential health problems toward the end of life. And so what we did for them is we encouraged them to sell the condo, which they did. And that had two basic effects. Number one, it reduced their monthly expenses by $1,000, which again helped them to keep from dipping into their principal. The other thing it did is it provided them with some working capital that we could use to put into some deferred annuity product that would eventually be used to fund their long-term care expenses down the road. And the third thing that we did for them was that we created an investment plan for them that would give them some more investment income than they were getting from their CDs at the bank. Between the bonds and the stocks we placed them in, they were going to get another $14,000 a year in income, which is not insignificant. So just by making a few, frankly, pretty simple changes for this couple, we were able to really take care of two of their biggest concerns in retirement.
Yeah, I think one of the critical things, and this, Kathleen, came about when you go through the budgeting process. And I know if you're listening to this program, budgeting is probably not your favorite topic, but it was really going through the budgeting process that made them realize, oh my goodness, we're spending almost $1,000 a month on the condo and we're spending less than 2 weeks. That doesn't make sense for us now. It might have made sense during their working career where they could afford that because they had salaries. And so that was less of an issue. But now that they were retired, living on fixed income, Joe's pension plus Social Security for both Joe and Irene, now was a big issue. And especially with Irene's mom going into a retirement home and longevity on both sides of the fence, that was something that was very, very important. And what we did here, Kathleen, was there wasn't one investment. I couldn't say, look, let's just all put it into blue chip stocks and that's going to solve all your problem, because it wouldn't. And first of all, I don't think Joe and Irene would have gone for putting 100% of their assets in the stock market. But by putting their money in laddered bonds where they had a predictable stream of income, and that was half of the portfolio, so if the market went down, you know, it wasn't everything they had, which was the main reason they went into bank CDs when they retired at the end of 2008. And so it gave them a predictable income stream. And they also had the stocks not only providing income, but they now had an inflation hedge, because that was another concern. Everybody, I don't care who you talk to, I think would be fair to say that if they were looking 10 years out from now, I don't know anybody that I've talked to that expects that they would have lower expenses. Maybe 10 years from now, Joe and Irene may not be taking as many trips. But if they do take a trip 10 years from now, I would venture to say that any trip they take 10 years from now is going to cost a lot more than what they're spending today. But we basically used a couple things. Budgeting. Taking a look at an asset, here a second home that it didn't make sense to keep, because they can still go skiing. You know, it's a lot cheaper to go rent a hotel up in Mammoth than it is to maintain a condo there. So we used bonds, we used annuities, we used stocks, and we also sold basically an unproductive asset, which was the condo, which they really didn't realize how much they were spending, because it was more important to them to make sure, especially with Irene's mom in a retirement home, to take care of long-term health care issues, because they didn't have the budget. They had no way they could come up with $6,500 annually to pay for long-term care insurance. So here was a case, Kathleen, where we use multiple strategies, multiple investment classes to solve their problems.
As we mentioned earlier, you know, Irene's mom is in a care facility right now. And I'm sure like a lot of our clients and friends are listening here to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income series. A lot of us have friends and family that are in these care facilities. And there are certain things to keep your eyes open for. And coming up next in the program, Jim, you're going to be talking to Dr. Bonnie Olson. Again, she's a clinical professor at the University of California in their Irvine School of Medicine. She's part of their program in geriatrics. Jim and Bonnie will be talking about elder fraud and elder abuse. So again, if you're someone that has an aging parent, good program to keep your ears open for and to listen to.
Joining me on the program today is Dr. Bonnie Olson. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and a clinical professor at the University of California Irvine School of Medicine program in geriatrics. Doctor, I read somewhere that the financial loss of elder financial exploitation is estimated to run somewhere in the neighborhood of about $3 billion, and it's increasing each year. Let's talk about what is elder abuse. It encompasses so many things, but if you were to generalize, what is it?
Well, indeed it does. Elder abuse is a very complex issue that includes both financial abuse, physical abuse, emotional, as well as sometimes sexual, and sometimes things like isolation and abandonment or just leaving someone without adequate care. So it runs a wide gamut of ways in which elders are mistreated in our communities.
Doctor, who is vulnerable to elder abuse? Is it just a surviving spouse?
Really, any elder is vulnerable if they have some conditions. All of us potentially could be vulnerable, but certainly we see that folks who are isolated from family or close relationships, that certainly raises the vulnerability. And probably the largest thing that we see repetitively is when individuals have any kind of cognitive changes, things like the onset of memory loss or dementia, that really creates an enormous amount of vulnerability for people to take advantage of them.
What are some of the warning signs that one should look at? We think of people, our grandparents or even our parents as they age. Gosh, dad's getting a little bit more forgetful. Mom's a little bit more forgetful. I mean, we're used to seeing those kind of things, but are those the kind of signs we look for?
Well, yes, certainly when someone starts to become forgetful, it's important to develop a plan in conjunction with the older adult as to how to best protect their assets, as well as identifying how they want to be cared for as they age, particularly if their memory loss advances. The signs that we really encourage families to look for is any significant change in behavior, whether that's spending patterns that might indicate that someone's taking advantage of them financially, or if there's a change in the way the individual is interacting with the family, perhaps cutting folks off or not being as engaged as they once were, that those really do indicate something's amiss and it deserves a good close look.
What about a surviving spouse that lives alone?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen issues come up where there's just self-neglect.
Yes.
I guess if mom or dad lives by themselves, might be a useful thing to do is occasionally check in with mom or dad and see how they're doing.
Absolutely. The more contact, the more involvement extended family can have with elders, the better they are at protecting them, because they're going to see a change before it gets out of hand or before there's something that really can harm the parent. They can intervene, hopefully.
Doctor, what makes older adults vulnerable to abuse? Is it just that maybe their mental faculties aren't what they once were? I mean, why do we see this so much with, well, let's take the term, elder abuse?
Well, I think that it doesn't require that there be a diagnosable condition like a dementia, although, as I mentioned, that makes it much more likely to happen. But really, anything that creates vulnerability in the individual sets up the possibility that abuse can happen. And we think about things like even depression or loneliness, certainly grief. When people are really in a state of grief, they're vulnerable because if there's a perpetrator, they're looking for someone to take advantage of, they'll see that this is an individual who they could easily convince or get them to behave in ways that they normally wouldn't. So we often look for sort of patterns of change that occur that are sometimes multifactorial. So there's a lot of things happening at the same time. But really, lots of our seniors who are isolated, alone, and particularly those cognitive changes, if those are happening, it certainly creates that vulnerability.
You know, one thing that we saw, and this was an actual case, this happened to us several months ago, where we got a phone call supposedly from one of our older clients. Actually, it was a man posing as a female. Our client lives here, and this particular individual was in Florida. They had gotten a hold of the client's bank account. I guess they had tapped in through email or tapped into her computer and wanted us to transfer a large amount of money to a bank in Florida. And luckily, we knew enough about the client that we could ask questions. Gee, what was your husband's name? You know, just personal stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to find out it was a fraud. But here was a simple case of somebody just hacked into our client's computer.
Yes, I know. And it makes me think that some of us need to just be really a lot more careful about all that personal information so that we can protect ourselves. That's not just elders. That's all of us that need to watch out for that. But I think as folks get older, it's a lot harder to understand all the technology and what kinds of things are safe to do or to share, like over a telephone or, you know, if someone calls and solicits information. It's really hard for older folks to understand what to share and what not to.
Who are the abusers of older people, if I may ask, Doctor? In this case, this was obviously a younger individual, a criminal that had hacked into our client's computer system. But generally, if you were to categorize who these people are, is it family, friends, who?
The largest group of perpetrators, particularly when we're talking about financial elder abuse, really has to do with family members. And it might be adult children who are nominated as the person to make the financial decisions for an elder parent and take advantage of that role and use the seniors' funds for their own use rather than for the seniors' care that we see repetitively all the time. But there are other forms of financial abuse that occur. Sometimes there's professional folks that come in and take advantage. We see lots of inappropriate reverse mortgages sold under somewhat false circumstances. Sometimes we see small business fraud where contractors come in and sell the senior services that are unnecessary and grossly overcharged. And then there's large-scale fraud that occurs, and sweepstakes and lottery scams where seniors are victimized by being told they've won the lottery, but they need to pay some funds that represent taxes or some false idea like that. And many seniors lose their entire life savings by paying that money up front, believing that they've won a large sweepstakes or lottery. So it takes all those different forms, and they're complicated and difficult sometimes to remediate.
Yeah, you mentioned something like reverse mortgages. Even financial professionals were, we see many times, a surviving spouse. Maybe the husband was the individual that managed the family's investment portfolio. The husband passes away. The wife is not really familiar with financial markets, and they're susceptible to some kind of investment scam, or what we see a lot of times is a spouse may be sold a asset that isn't especially appropriate, or take all their assets and put it into one high commission product, whether it's annuity or whether it's a backloaded mutual fund, but they're not familiar with the financial markets, so they fall prey to financial misuse.
Indeed, we see that happen a lot. And I think in those cases, there isn't a disorder or something that the individual has that creates the vulnerability, but it's really naivety and lack of experience in the financial world. Certainly, we would really encourage individuals who, you know, are a widow or a widower and are left to manage finances that they don't have that life experience in their background to seek professional help, and particularly to engage a family member that they trust in the process so that they're sharing those decision-making process and not doing that in isolation and creating that vulnerability.
What are the factors that make it easy for this crime of opportunity to occur? Is it just the fact, doctor, that people are living longer, so we have problems with memory loss as a person ages? Because, you know, I've been in this business 3 decades, and when I first got in this business back in the early 1980s, we were doing trusts. We always named the kids as successor trustees. But over the last 15 years, I'm seeing more elder abuse from the children, as we just discussed. And also the fact that many of these people, if you take their life expectancy at the time they were born, I mean, they were supposed to live like a male was supposed to live to age 65. Many of these males now are living into their 80s, if not 90s. I just had a client pass away last week at the age of 99.
Wow. Yes. And that's wonderful that we have much greater longevity now. I think it's a function of doing a better job of treating lots of illnesses that at one time would have taken our lives. Now we have the interventions that we can actually live into, you know, those decades, into our 90s and sometimes beyond. But it does leave those individuals with a long time of retirement that they have to finance and have those resources available. I think that this generation who are now in their 80s and late 70s, it seems, have acquired, in many cases, a fair amount of wealth, anticipating that they'll need a fair amount of resources to take care of themselves throughout their retirement period. And just the amount of wealth they've acquired and that financial instruments are so complex these days, it creates that vulnerability. It's a complex world we live in, and it's really hard for people to figure out how to secure their assets and yet have them be available for their use. Complicated.
What are the warning signs to watch for, doctor? In other words, if there are children who are concerned about their parents or grandparents, what are the things they should be looking for?
I would say the biggest thing is that there be an open discussion between whether it's children or grandchildren and the senior to understand what their assets are and what their wishes are, so that there's a clear understanding from all the parties involved as to who's going to be in the position of making decisions for the senior should they need that kind of help. And an effort to collaborate, if you will, so that decisions are made jointly and that everyone's aware of what's going on. Sort of a level of transparency in discussions, I think, really helps to protect the senior from being taken advantage of by other family members that may not have the senior's best interest at heart.
Doctor, what about a corporate trustee? One of the ways that we've been able to protect some of our clients have been using corporate trustees to either be a co-trustee with one of the children or in other ways to be an institution that supervises and protects either mom or dad so they oversee. So if they see some kid saying, gee, I need to get 20, 30 grand from mom because we need a down payment on a house or I'm buying a new car. I actually had a situation where mom gave Junior money for a car because he was complaining he couldn't come and see mom as often because his car wasn't working right.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that might be appropriate if that's something that's consistent with mom's earlier way of managing funds, and gifting money to adult children is something that may very well be her intent and not a sign of abuse or mistreatment in any way. But on the other hand, if that's out of the ordinary for mom to do that, to gift large sums of money to adult children, then it probably represents in some regard some abuse of pressuring mom to give monies that might not otherwise be there for them. So it's a complex situation. It certainly makes sense to be aware of what the warning signs would be. And, you know, what represents a change, and to be sort of conscious of how an individual would normally manage their money. I think having a corporate trustee often can be really useful in protecting assets, particularly if there's conflict among siblings or within the family structure, so that there's some individuals who have greater need and maybe would exert that pressure on mom or dad to gift large sums of money. If that situation is present, then yes, having an outsider participate in that decision making with the senior, maybe in conjunction with another adult child, can often be really helpful to clarify what are the interests of the individual so that those are protected.
Doctor, what can people do? Let's say that you suspect somebody is the object of elder abuse. I mean, where do you go? I mean, is there a number? Do you call the police? I mean, who do you call in an instance like this?
Yeah, there's a whole organized response system in place in our communities. Certainly, the first avenue of seeking help is to call the agency called Adult Protective Services. And every county in California has an office with an 800 number that you can call. And it would be really important to understand that you don't call when you're sure there's abuse, but when you suspect there might be. No one will ever hold the caller responsible for being sure that abuse really did occur. And I think that's sometimes a misperception in the community. It makes sense to call even when you suspect that abuse may have occurred. And then they will take that information from you and then go out and visit with the senior in their home and investigate. If it appears that a crime may have occurred, they will also contact the police and get involved with investigating, and then the police become involved in investigating it as a crime. And then many other agencies may become involved as information becomes available as to what's occurred and what remedies would be most useful in protecting the victim and at times prosecuting the perpetrator when that's appropriate.
Let's talk about another situation that often arises. Let's say that mom or dad has the signs of dementia or Alzheimer's, surviving spouse, and a decision has to be made in terms of possible nursing home. In other words, that individual is no longer capable of taking care of themselves. Either they're not taking their meds, they're not functioning properly. That's a very difficult decision, and it's a personal one, and sometimes an older person may feel that the children are just trying to get rid of mom and dad. How do you handle situations like that?
Well, again, these are really complicated decision-making processes. Probably the first thing that I think makes sense is to seek some medical advice regarding what the individual's care needs actually are. And one of the programs that we have here at UCI at the Medical Center in Orange is a comprehensive health assessment, which generates a report and clear guidelines as to here's the disorders that the individual is struggling with, and here is the level of care that would support their highest level of functioning. And sometimes it is very useful to get that kind of information so that then families can make really informed decisions about the best setting to provide the care in. Now, that said, I think that it is then a personal decision, and sometimes there isn't an optimal setting, meaning that one can receive care at home with caregivers that come and provide that in the home setting, or they can move to something like an assisted living or a board and care facility where care is provided by staff that are present at the facility. Now, there's not a better approach. Sometimes it's what's most fitting to that individual's values and preferences. And sometimes it's a financial decision that depends on what other assets they have and what makes sense. And then sometimes it's a level of care issue, where if an individual really needs more care than can realistically be provided in a home setting, then sometimes a nursing home or placement in an assisted living is really ideal. So there's not a one-size-fits-all kind of response to that, but certainly exploring the options and then identifying what makes the most sense for that individual at this point in time.
Doctor, finally, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more information about elder abuse, or if they suspect it, you talked about adult protective services. Mm-hmm. Is there an information source or a website that they can go to get more information?
Well, probably the best place to start is at the National Center of Elder Abuse, which is currently housed here at UCI. As part of our program, we were awarded that sort of designation and so are functioning in that role. And their website for your audience is www.ncea.aoa.gov. And that will lead you right to the website regarding the National Center of Elder Abuse, where there's a lot of information to help protect family members or yourself and ways to respond should you identify abuse or suspect it in your community.
Listen, Doctor, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. We've been speaking with Dr. Bonnie Olson. She's clinical psychologist and clinical professor at the University of California Irvine School of Medicine and Program in Geriatrics. Doctor, I wish you all the best, and thanks for coming on the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
That concludes our interview this week with Dr. Bonnie Olson. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.